Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by CMN Momentum 2020 Online is the unique event for ministry-minded Catholics. Join us July 15th and 16th and jumpstart your good work for God. This two-day event offers best practice conference presenters and a virtual trade show. Also included are film screenings, music guests, and even a pro-life voter town hall. CMN is where Catholic businesses and nonprofits, leaders and volunteers, are empowered with practical hope and help during these hard times. Visit CatholicMarketing.com and register today. Your Catholic organization can join Catholic Marketing Network so you and four members of your team can attend Momentum 2020 for free. In addition to free access, a $75 CMN membership provides year-round benefits for Catholic schools, nonprofits, church fundraising teams, retailers, and more. Visit CatholicMarketing.com and register, and get ready to build professional and personal momentum.
Hey, one. Good evening and welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio 980 on your dial. Glad to have you with us tonight. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m. Glad you could join us. We're here every Monday night, 10 to 11, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Well, tonight, ladies and gentle things, we go beneath the surface on the topic of human nature and sports. Why we have them, when why we care so much about them. And our guest tonight on Beneath the Surface is Mr. Daniel Flaherty, first-time BTSer. He is the owner of thesportsnetwork.com and author of the book, Great 1980s Sports Moments. Dan, welcome to Beneath the Surface.
Thank you very much, Paul. Good to be here.
You ready to delve beneath the surface with us tonight on the topic of sports?
I absolutely am. Let's get into it.
Fantabulous. And to his left and to my right is our regular guest, Mr. John Tudoris. John Tesaurus, welcome back.
Woohoo!
What's happening?
It is. Today's happening.
Today is happening?
Beautiful weather.
And tonight is happening.
Yes, it is.
And happening is Cindy behind the glass. Cindy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Fantabulous. What's it like being you tonight?
Just hanging out, doing your show.
Yes, that's what you're doing, and I'm glad you are. Our phone number here at the show is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. If you want to get involved in our conversation, we'd love to have you here on BTS Radio. Gentlemen.
Where?
Right there in front of me, whether you realize it or not. Gentlemen, an interesting topic tonight. Human nature in sports. Why we have them and why we care about them so much. So before we go beneath the surface on this question, Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit first about thesportsnetwork.com. When did you create this? Why did you create this? And tell us a little something about it.
Okay, but it's thesportsnotebook.com.
The sports notebook.
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
And I created it in late 2011. I had been doing sports blogging on a number of different platforms. Geez, probably going back to 2005, 2006, on a wide range of topics. I had written about the Red Sox. I had written about Big Ten football.
Now, when you were living in 2005, 2006, where were you living?
I was living in Pittsburgh at that time.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You weren't even a Boston... You didn't even grow up here, did you?
No, but I've always been kind of like a Boston by desire, shall we say. Like, you know, ever since I was in college, and I don't know why or
is
where.
Is that kind of like
from.
Baptism by desire?
That was kind of the implication I was drawing, yeah.
Boston by desire, okay.
Right, yeah.
That's an interesting one. Is that a better microphone? All right, why don't you change mics, Dan, because there's a better one right next to you.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Coming through here?
Absolutely. I like that one better.
Yeah, but it was probably by the mid to late 90s I really got into Boston sports teams. I say that to clarify for the audience that I didn't just jump on the bandwagon when they began winning every championship known to man, like every couple of years. So.
Yeah, so you decided to... Is your website a blogosphere? I mean, explain it a little.
Okay, well, it's not a blog in the sense that the most current content, it's not just a scroll of the most current content. I think it's a website. There's a historical database of articles, mostly of a historical nature, that there's probably like 3,000 or so on there that I've written over the last 6 years. Okay. And then there's also a daily blog where I just, that's on the right-hand side, where I write on current topics and events, you know, as they're developing. And then my book, Great 1980 Sports Moments, is prominently located. And then I've also got a number of downloads that just look back on past baseball, NFL, and college football seasons that are posted, and they're up there as well.
So you wrote a book called, as you just mentioned, the Great 1980 Sports Moments.
That's right.
Why did you choose that decade?
Well, I was working on I was going to start from when I could first remember sports, which would be, for me, around 1975, 76. I was going to start with the Carlton Fisk home run off the foul pole in the World Series.
Wow.
And
what a moment.
That's right. And I was going to go all the way up to the present day. I mean, this was a few years ago, so I had American Pharoah winning the Triple Crown a couple of years ago. It was going to be my last one. And I kind of realized that there's a thing called biting off more than you can chew, and maybe I'm going to have a tome so big that nobody will be able to get through it.
And you need a sequel.
That's right, yeah. So I just kind of took a look at it, and I thought, like, people are interested in the 1980s. It is the generation that I grew up in. There's kind of a shared experience that's involved with people of my generation. And it was nice kind of showing it to my friend's kids, too, and saying, hey, this is the moments that me and your dad, you know, grew up on watching together. And that kind of relates to our topic tonight, because, like, shared experience is one of the things that kind of brings... You know, makes us fully human, you know, when we're participating in sports.
So your website and your book relate to various sports, right?
Yes.
Not just the big four that Boston sports fans are most familiar with.
Right. Yeah, no, they do primarily build around that, but there's a lot. I do a lot of college sports. I mean, coming from the Midwest as I do, the Big Ten is huge. So, you know, I love college football, college basketball.
It's funny. New Englanders don't care about college sports by and large.
I know. I kind of knew that when I came out here, but having said that, I was still kind of surprised when I'd be looking at March Madness and people would be like,
whatever.
That? Yeah.
Very good. John, any 2 cents so far? Don't want you to just sit there.
UConn would be the exception on sports.
If you live in Connecticut, people up here don't care about UConn.
Not really, no.
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 People up here probably care most about Boston College. If they would have
choose one. Yeah, but that ended at Flutie.
Pretty much.
Pretty much. That was, what, over 20? That was in the 80s, right?
Speaking of great 1980 sports moments, that's there. So
Nice.
Now, there were some great 1980 sports moments in the Boston area, wasn't there?
Yes, there was, yeah. Mm. I mean, now, of course, one of them has a very bad connotation to it with a ground ball going through Bill Buckner's legs. But one of the things I kind of point out to is I think most diehard Red Sox fans from that era will remember that the Red Sox also pulled off a stunning comeback against the Angels.
The Angels in Game 5. Yeah. They were down 2-0. It was 3 out of 5 back then.
No, it was still best. It had just become best of 7.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I thought it was 3 out of 5.
No, a 3 out of 5 ended in 1984. So we were just in the early part of the best of 7. But you're basically right that the Red Sox were 2 games down.
That was three games to one. 3 games to 1 they were losing. And they came back. Tell me about the Henderson home run. Do you remember the Henderson home run?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
In Game 7?
Yeah.
Was it Game 7 or was it Game...
That was Game 5.
5, because they were about to lose it altogether, and he kept it alive.
Yeah, they were behind 5-2 in the ninth. And then, first Don Baylor hit a 2-run home run to make it 5-4, and then it got interesting. And then I think it was Rich Gedman who drew a walk. Hmm. And then Gene Walk, the Angels manager, made a move that still is kind of debated among hardcore baseball historians.
He kept in Donnie Moore?
No, he pulled Mike Witt, the starting pitcher.
Okay.
And then he brought in a lefty, Gary Lucas. Lucas hit Gedman, so that brought the winning run to the plate. Then he brings in Moore.
Donnie Moore, yeah.
And then Moore just threw, I think it was a splitter, kind of landed down around the knees in Henderson's hot spot, and he just he golfed it out.
Right.
And that was it.
Incredible.
And the Red Sox, you know, rolled over him, and once they came back to Fenway. For the
that was an
year.
Incredible moment. You know, I I even hesitate to go beneath the surface on the deeper questions here because this is bringing back a lot of memories. That you mentioned the Carlton Fisk home run. My gosh, that was amazing. You know what? It made such a memorable moment and such a memorable series that you would think that the Red Sox won the World Series that year, and they
did
not.
I know.
They won Game 6, but then they lost Game 7, and nobody even cares.
I've often thought, like, I wonder how Reds fans feel when that series gets recalled.
Yeah.
They want to say, like, hello, we won it over here.
Right. You know? It seems like the whole country remembers the Red Sox winning that series, and they never did.
And not only did they win it, but, like, Game 7 was an all-time great game. It's like,
that was good.
It was a tie game in the ninth inning, and Joe Morgan hit a little bloop single with two outs and a man on third
to win the game.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. See, I remember in 86 against the Mets, remember it was a rainout? Game 7 was rained out.
Yeah.
Game 7 was rained out, and Oriel Can Boyd was going to pitch that game, but it was rained out. So because they had an extra day or two, they had Bruce Hurst come in to pitch Game 7. And the Red Sox were up something like by 3 runs.
3-0. Yeah, and, into the fifth or sixth
inning. Into the fifth or sixth inning, exactly. So you're thinking, okay, this looks pretty good. Then, of course, the Mets came back, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But, man, there were a lot of painful Boston sports moments in the 1980s, and there were a lot of jubilant ones.
That's right.
The Celtics come to mind, of course.
Oh, yeah, and certainly Larry Bird's. You can't write a book about 1980s in sports without the Bird Magic storyline being there throughout. You know, they had those great finals battles they played.
Well, it started in college.
Right,
and,
yeah, of course.
The finals game, right?
Right, yeah, that would have been in 79.
Michigan versus...
Michigan State and Indiana State.
Indiana State.
Yeah.
And Magic won that one.
That's right.
Yeah. And then they went into the pros, and Magic, of course, was drafted by the Lakers and Bird to the Celtics.
Mm-hmm.
And their epic battles beginning in 1981.
Well, the first time they played...
No, that was Houston, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It was in 84 that the first time they played each other in the
first
finals.
First time they played head-to-head.
Yeah.
But, of course, before that, you had Bird with some great battles against, you know, Dr. J and the 76ers. And speaking of rivalries, that could be getting reignited.
Reignited, yes, absolutely. Wow. 978-454-4980. Our topic tonight on Beneath the Surface is human nature and sports, why we have them and why we care so much about them. Well, let's start with that question. Why don't we go a little beneath the surface here on sports? Why sports? It seems like they are created things in order to have competition with other fellow humans that people tend to feel good about, and we keep doing them. Why? What's the purpose?
Well, I think there's a few that come to mind. One is that it's kind of a proxy for life.
A proxy for life.
Yes, there's a strange echo.
That's okay.
Oh, that's good. So, thinking about all the drama that goes on within sports.
Yes.
And within the span of 1 to 3 hours, I mean, it's like you're watching an opera. For those who like opera.
So it's entertainment.
Entertainment, it's cathartic, you laugh, you cry.
But it's not art. Let's go beneath the surface here. We're usually entertained by artistic things, right? Like music or a play or something. So...
But sports more like life.
Sports is more like life than art is like life. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. In so much as the art is designed, it's
yep.
willfully crafted.
Right.
Sport, at least not sports entertainment. That's you know, wrestling entertainment. That would be more like art.
But what art and sports have in common, and I think you mentioned this already, is the component of drama.
Yes, lots of drama.
We like drama. Why do we humans like drama so much?
I don't know, Dan. Why do we like drama?
No, I don't know why we like drama, but I'd like to pick up on the art, you know, comparison that you made there. Because, now, I don't know if in a philosophical sense sports can be compared to art. I'd certainly defer to John on that.
Well, actually, you could make a case for that in both cases. Because art, in the classical sense, we're going back to ancient philosophy, is that you are using your reason... you know, you're actually combining it in a certain way, a amount of science, but then you have a production of something, right? In this case, it's not so much a production of maybe a sculpture or a house or food, but in this case, the production is the activity itself of sport.
It's,
Think of someone like a Larry Bird, right? I mean, Larry Bird was a smart player, and he was a smart coach, too. And actually, it's funny you guys are mentioning that as an aside, because someone had all these clips of Larry Bird, and there was a running joke that he was a smart, slow white guy with no leaping capability whatsoever.
That's about right.
And it was actually completely incorrect. I saw these highlights.
You think he can leap?
Actually, he did quite a few. He had some not full-on Jordan soaring jams,
right,
but he got well above the reputed 5 inches vertical leap. We'll put it that way. He had some pretty fantastic shots.
He had some great shots.
But think about it, like the science, the knowledge that he had of basketball on the court, where the ball would go.
That's another question. Is it more of a science or more of an art?
It's both.
It's both. So
art always includes science. That's important to know.
So one of the attractions of sports is that it combines elements of art and science.
Well, yes. I mean, science being knowledge of things through their causes. So Larry, being a student of the game, for example, would have a better understanding of where the ball is going to rebound off, so he can be in the right position to get the ball. And he had a superior knowledge and execution of how to square up properly and how to get the ball just right so it hits the backboard to get a switch.
That would be the case with any sport.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a sign. I can't believe our first segment is already gone. That's crazy. What were you going to say, Dan?
Oh, I was just. We might have to pick this up after commercial here, but I would say, like, from the art standpoint, there's just such an inherent creativity in sports. Like, when you think like a Larry Bird, you know, maybe some of us could envision him with his back to the basket, his peripheral vision going, just knowing where that ball was going to get reversed to just the right spot to the open three-point shooter.
Yeah.
And that's more just meant to be appreciated in the sense that you would appreciate a great piece of art. And then there's also a scientific component, which has really gained steam in recent years with this, you know, statistical analytics revolution.
And yes.
You know, can't get through a game without 25 different stats being thrown at you. That's the scientific component.
Yes.
And
there's art in it, there's science in it, and you know what? There's childhood in it.
Yeah.
What do? As soon as we begin to learn to walk, we start to play, right? I want to, after the break, I want to delve beneath the surface on childlike play in relationship to professional sports. 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP. Don't go away, but we'll be right back. Too funny. You can count on Cindy. Now, this is a sports song.
Well, I beat the drum and hold the phone. The sun came out today.
Woo!
We're born.
Not going to be rained out.
There's new grass on the field.
New grass, too. All right, what's the name of that song, Cindy?
That's called Center Field.
Center Field, that's right. Who sings it?
John Fogerty.
John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival fame.
Yep.
You got it. 978-454-4980 is the BTS hotline. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano, as usual. At least the last time I checked, I still am. My guests in front of me are Mr. Dan Flaherty, who is the owner of thesportsnotebook.com and author of the book Great 1980 Sports Moments. Dan, can you get this off Amazon.com?
Yes, you can. It's available in electronic, audio, print.
The author's name again is Dan Flaherty. The book is the Great 1980 Sports Moments, and for Boston fans, there are certainly a lot of them to ponder. And next to him is Mr. John Tudors, Beneath the Surface regular. John, welcome to segment two.
Yes, I am regular.
You are right. Okay. So, I'm not interested in your personal life, but thank you for that. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. Okay, before the break, I would like to get your... we were talking about play. I'd like to get your take on this. What is the relationship between sports and child's play, and then the relationship between sports and games? Is there a fine line there? Go.
Age before beauty.
Let me take a look, take a try at this here. I mean, sports, you know, there's a certain amount of innocence in childhood. And that I think even as adults, we always have to try to recapture a certain amount of childhood innocence, you know, even as we carry about our adult duties. And I don't know, for me, like, sports has always been a way to kind of connect to that. And I know, you know, therapists will talk about using things like art therapy for, you know, creativity to kind of, like...
To get in touch with yourself? Or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a little too, But in some way, to just kind of what I'll call reconnect with original innocence at some way.
Like. Very interesting. Did you think there were sports in the Garden of Eden?
There probably weren't, unless Adam and Eve played one-on-one. I don't know. But in all truth, like, I guess, you know, if you look at the world to come, like, I believe that there would be, you know, competition in heaven because...
Yeah. Because it's fun.
That's right. It's joy.
There's something fun about competing.
That's right. And when you, you know, we talked about it, you know, sports being creative.
Yeah.
You know, anytime you create, you're participating in the creative life of the creator himself.
Yes. Life is a drama. And I think, like John was saying earlier, sports is a little microcosm of life. Because you don't know who's going to win, who's going to step up, who's going to do the right thing. Who's going to get the who's going to be the hero? Who's going to be the villain? All that kind of stuff. And it's interesting how, when you're a sports fan, when you're watching it, there are good guys and bad guys. Now, your team, of course, are the good guys. And you know, whenever my wife talks about sports and we talk about who's winning, she says the good guys are winning 3-1. You know, we call them the good guys and the bad guys. It's kind of humorous, but there's something about having an affection for your home team and thinking of the other guys as the other. They're the enemy. They're the opponents. And, of course, this is really played up and magnified when it comes to sports rivalries like Red Sox-Yankees and other Celtics-Lakers. Tell me a little bit about that rivalry or that passion that people have to actually love their team and hate the other guy. Why is that? Why do we do that? We don't even know these people that are playing.
Well, you know, I'm really going to defer to John, because as I was thinking about this question today, I just thought, like, I've asked that question of myself so many times. Like, when
most sports fans do, and we don't understand why.
Right, I'm sitting here, like, watching the Yankees and thinking, like, you know, if I met all 25 of these guys, I'd probably think most of them were nice people.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, like, put them in a jersey and suddenly...
They're the enemy.
Yeah. That's right,
There seems to be something visceral, something on the intuitive level that... we recognize that our team is so important to us in some way. I have a theory about this, but let me hear yours, John.
I'll hear yours first.
Well, I there's a couple of theories that are not really... They're loose theories. Number one, I think humanity has evolved out of a tribal warfare kind of state of life. And back then, of course... When your team was fighting the other team, it literally was for life and death. We have substituted that, and thankfully we have, because it's much less violence, vicariously rooting for sports teams to beat the other guys than for the tribes to beat the other tribes. So perhaps it's a vicarious psychological need to win in that respect. It's sort of just replaced that... That tribal warfare mentality that humanity has had for so many centuries, I suppose. And then even before that, there was always that battle of humanity versus animal for both food and for safety. And there were probably hundreds of thousands of years of that battle between those two parties. And between those two things, perhaps... Because of technology and our modern way of living, we have substituted those life and death situations to something much more safe, and we even made it fun in sports. But we still hold on to that. We've got to win, and if we don't win, we're miserable.
Actually, I want to get a little bit more on the battle.
Okay.
Just add another aspect, which is somewhat common in most sports, but I found, interestingly enough, that some of the most violent ones, like football and contact sports, like mixed martial arts, is actually the players on both sides greeting each other quarterly after the fact. I mean, if you look in professional football, NFL, almost every single game, without fail, after the players are beating the snot out of each other, no matter what goes on in the game, they're going out to the other players.
Yeah.
They're giving them hugs. Good game,
it's amazing,
having
isn't
conversations.
It?
There's prayer groups.
Boxers.
Yeah, there's prayer groups, and then like in...
Ultimate
Fighting, mixed martial arts. You'll have a lot of the players. They'll go in there, and to them, it's actually like a chess match. They're not just like straight-up street brawlers. To them, it's actually a skill.
Yeah.
And if they mess up just a little bit, and the other guy capitalizes on it, you know, they're a little down on them. Well, not a little. A lot of them are very down that they're lost, but you know what? They're like, that was a good match. That guy was really good.
And then there's the formal tradition of hockey players shaking hands with each other in line at the end of a playoff series.
Still
to this
day.
That's right. And that's always been kind of ironic, too, because hockey is just renowned, as at least of the four major sports, as being the one most prone to
fighting,
glorifying violence and fighting. Yeah.
And perhaps maybe that's something telling, too, about something deeper about it. So this proxy for this tribal warfare.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, as a quote-unquote civilized people, we can still go over and we can shake their hand. We can meet them as human beings.
Yes. That's the good part.
Yes.
Now, could we also see, on a spiritual level, sports as being a metaphor for the battle against sin?
Oh, goodness, yes. It requires virtue to win in sports.
Oh, yeah.
Fortitude, temperance, actually.
Yeah.
But think about it. The best players aren't the ones who are the most flashy. They're the ones who are the best at doing the basics. And the only way is to actually tread the middle ground, really. You're not going too far in extreme one way or the other. You're meeting the skill where it needs to be at. Think about like a golf swing, how precise and particular that is in order to get that ball to go straight exactly where you want it to go and not slice off one way or the other. You have to go a certain direction, not one way out the other way or this way or that way, just right down the middle, so to speak, exactly where it needs to be. And that requires virtue and practice and fortitude and patience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing I'd also say, too, is like, you know, of the players that kind of tend to most practice what we'll call finding that middle ground of really taking care of themselves, developing themselves, maximizing their talent, we as fans tend to be drawn to them. Like I always had great respect for Tim Duncan, the former great player with the San Antonio Spurs, like, who was basically so boring, he was nicknamed the Big Fundamental. But like that's
a good nickname for him.
That's right.
He wasn't flashy whatsoever.
That's right.
Yet he won championships.
Right, but like he won, and there was
reminds me of Bill Russell.
That's right. Yeah, but Russell was another great one.
He wasn't Will Chamberlain, but he won championships.
But Russell knew how to win. He knew how to invest himself in his teammates in ways that I think are, you know, very telling toward lessons in, you know, in the spiritual life, both individually and as a community.
Sports also is another way to harness aggression. You could say that we, since the fall, we have had sort of an imbalanced, particularly males, a kind of a masculine aggression. And, of course, the modern world today is trying to stifle that to an unnatural level. They've gone way over the other extreme and trying to stifle masculinity. But perhaps we could see sports as a way of getting that out in a forum that is safe, that is secure, and like John said, that is even gentlemanly at the end.
Oh, big time.
I think that's completely accurate. I just think back up to like my days playing high school football, and you know, the guys who were the best players on that didn't tend to be like angry people in the hallways at school or anything like that. You know, everything was poured out on the football field in a very controlled manner.
What's the nickname for football? Chest that hurts.
Chest that hurts. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of the modern movement of women in sports? Now, I know women have always been in sports, by and large, but it seems to be more and more, at least, attempted to be pushed by the networks and, you know, the WNBA, for example, and
which
nobody watches, and the Olympics. More and more women are being prominently shown, and There's a whole PC culture relating to women in sports today. Title IX, I believe it was, or was it Title X?
Title IX.
Title IX, back in the 19, whatever it was, 60s to 70s. Do you find this a natural progression of women competing aggressively in sports, particularly in male-dominated sports like hockey and football and boxing? Or do you find, are you a little troubled by this?
I guess maybe I'm maybe a little bit more liberal on this one. I'm not all that disturbed by it.
Okay. You like to see women beating each other
up? I don't necessarily enjoy it or anything like that, but like of the women that I have met that have played sports, they all just seem very well-balanced people. Now, granted, I've never met Ronda Rousey personally or anything like that. And, you know, and it's not like I watch the WNBA or anything like that. But
are you attracted to, suppose, would you be attracted to, say, a woman football player?
Do you mean soccer?
No.
Or
hockey player or boxer?
Let's put it this way. I wouldn't be unattracted to her simply because...
Because of that.
Because of that.
Right, right. So does the WNBA attract you as a fan as much as the NBA does?
No, it doesn't, but that's more just because I've run out of time in terms of what I can jam into my sports calendar. There's a part of me that wishes I could keep up more with, like, the women's college basketball tournament, you know, the WNBA. Like, I think those kind of things, like, you know, are healthy, and they are good. I just think of, like, you know, there was a girl I knew a while back who played college basketball, and again, very well-balanced, mature, you know, virtuous, you know, person, because I think that does bring that out, you know, in women as well. You know, I don't know all the intricacies of how they react competitively and everything, but...
Before modern times, our contemporary age, even when I was in high school, if girls played sports, they were seen as more masculine, and it was kind of rare. Most girls wanted to be cheerleaders. Now, people listening to the show right now are saying, oh boy, that's really sexist to say that.
That's true, though.
We've come a long way, baby, when it comes to that. But John, do you think that this equalization in the world of sports is good for humanity? Are we trying to create two of the same kinds of people?
Well, we in the royal we sense of whatever this movement is that's pushing through, that's what it seems to be the case. And the big error on that, so I'm not denying that there's virtue to be had in playing sports for both genders. I think it's healthy. It teaches things like teamwork, you know, perseverance, fortitude, balance, a lot of these things, but it should always be seen in the context of the greater, you know, role in life, right? Mm. So it's not that the game should supplant what's real in life, rather it should be complementary. And one of the things
to life,
and one of the key things to know about life as it relates to humanity is that while men and women are equal in dignity, we are not the same, and that is an important distinction.
And how do you relate that to sports?
Well, in sports, you know, for example, there's a reason why there are different leagues and groupings of sports due to gender.
Men's, women's,
exactly. In general, men are taller, bigger, stronger, faster, have greater bone density.
But don't you think, if you follow the movement that's been happening, don't you think in maybe 10, 20, 50 years, leagues will be co-ed?
Absolutely not.
You don't think so? You don't think that'll ever happen?
Most on the major league level, no, because it's a loss in revenue. The dollar rules.
You think it's a financial thing only?
That's the main thing. The reason why we have the major sports leagues we have is because they know they can make money from it. It's a profitable product. But when you water down that profitable product too much,
yeah,
then, and then no one's buying it, it goes out the door.
But are you saying that if you were to admit women into men's leagues, it would water down the product? Is that what you're saying?
If it's forcibly done, a la affirmative action, absolutely. Completely watered down.
Dan, do you think, and we'll take a break after this question, Dan, do you think that the Olympics will soon or not so soon have competitions of mixed gender.
Yeah, I don't really see that moving toward, you know, going that direction again. Like, when I talk about the healthy aspect of women's sports, I think having men and women compete differently. And if you get the occasional woman who is, like, really good enough, like, you know, that could be, you know, could play.
That might happen.
Sure. And,
yeah.
You know, that could happen.
That could happen.
It hasn't happened yet. But if it does, you know, great. But I don't see it happening on a, you know.
All right. After the break, I want to ask you guys about this movement in the Olympics and perhaps other places of transgender people. 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano. You and I will be back right after this break. Backfield in motion.
Baby, you know that's against the rules.
Against the rules. 978-454-4980 is the BTS hotline. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP. And our topic tonight is human nature and sports, why we have them, and why we care so much about them. And again, my guest is Dan Flaherty and Mr. John Tudoris, BTS regular. And we've talked a whole lot about sports so far. In our last segment, we will begin with the question that I posed before the break. What do you think about the transgender movements within sports? Is it fair, Mr. John?
No, it is not.
Why is not? Why isn't it?
Because it ignores reality.
But doesn't the transgender movements in general ignore reality?
Yes, it does.
So then you're saying it's unfair not only in sports but in life to expect others to go along with
the
notion of... Okay.
Absolutely.
But when you take this... when you take somebody who is biologically a man who identifies as a woman into women's sports, it seems like, at least generally speaking, you may have an advantage.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And, well, think about it. When we, like, well, for example, when the PED scandal broke in baseball, right? Now, it had been going on...
PED as in
performance enhancing drugs.
Yeah.
Guys like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, just the whole lineup, Rafael Palmeiro, Mark McGuire, Sammy Sosa, just the list goes on. Players who basically probably won't see the light of day in the Hall of Fame because there was a hint, or some cases much more than a hint, that they may have used performance-enhancing drugs, even though they weren't considered illegal in professional baseball. They were actually permitted. But because it was considered an unfair advantage, baseball writers are pretty much not going to vote these guys in, and the only chance they ever have of getting in is on some veterans committee decades down the line, long after the baseball writers from now have since passed away. Now think about that,
yep.
And then say, in a situation like that, they vilify the unfair advantage, and yet, when it comes to something like transgender, people are willing to put something so basic and fundamental aside, which to even such a greater degree than performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's saying that a man, because he claims to be a woman, can compete in women's sports.
Yeah.
It's far more of an unfair advantage.
Okay.
In so many ways.
All right. So I would imagine both of you would be against just human enhancements, like we may be seeing in the future down the road, either genetic enhancements or mechanical enhancements to make somebody run faster or jump higher. All of those things, if you're a futurist and you look down the road, they seem to be coming. Should all of this be banned?
I'm going to basically say yes. You know, I already think football is hitting kind of a tipping point at the professional level with the bigger, faster, stronger ethic that drives these guys into these insane workout routines year-round, because the collisions are just coming at such... They're so violent now at the NFL level that it used to be you had to choose between whether you were a big guy or whether you were a fast guy. Now everybody is both.
Yeah.
And the collisions are just too strong, and I seriously doubt that the human body was made
to handle it, and it's why the defining story of every NFL season is not talent as much anymore. It's attrition. Who can stay healthy? And
it's funny. I don't know much about the sport of rugby. Do you?
No, I don't, but
okay.
I know you've got to be awfully tough to play it.
They don't have all the pads that American football has.
Right.
And yet, they do almost the same things. They run at each other. They hit each other.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not mistaken, and somebody could call and correct me here, I don't think they have as many injuries as football does.
They do, but they're smaller and, mm-hmm. to some degree, and more numerous. When I was at UMass, I didn't play rugby myself, but I knew a few people did, and some of them left their tomes up in the gym,
yeah.
the main gym.
This right.
is at the UMass Amherst campus, and talking about how like they have permanent arthritis in their hands from basically getting scrunched the way they did. So the violence is still there, but the extreme of the violence is what Dan is talking about.
Yes.
I completely agree with.
Yeah, and I was go ahead.
The bigger, stronger, faster, and you have better padding now than you did 30, 40,
well, that's
50
the question,
years ago.
And that's the question I was going to ask here. Is it better padding, or is it actually causing more of the injuries?
That question's actually...
Is it more defensive, or is it more offensive? That's the question here.
Well, if you got better padding, let's hit them
better, harder. That, again, is, yeah, you can, it can be used for defense and offensive purposes. And that's why I mentioned rugby. They don't have half the pads, and they have perhaps as many, but not more...
Well, and also the pads do interfere with your human instincts of to protect yourself as well too. So
yeah.
like you might leave yourself wide open a little bit too long.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in rugby and you're playing without the pads, you might just kind of curl away from a hit at the.
That's true. Let me shift a little bit to the psychology of home court advantage. If you watch the National Basketball Association, particularly in the playoffs. And I'll just give you an example. The Celtics-Cleveland Cavaliers series that's going on as we speak. It seems like a team has a great advantage when they play on their home court. Why is this? I mean, why is this? Aren't sports supposed to be, like you said, virtuous and just care about the truth? In that light, are referees being pressured by fans and so forth to give home team all the good calls? I mean, why is there such an advantage?
Well, I think it is going to be... It comes down to everybody feeding off the crowd. I don't know that the officials is as significant as it might have been 30 years ago before social media, because now the way every call gets scrutinized, I think officials are under the realization they're going to be under a lot more pressure if they blow a call everywhere after the game. But I mean, you think in terms of its effect on players and its ability to rattle their concentration if you're a road player, or to motivate them if you're a home player during a dry stretch of a game.
Yeah,
I think it's particularly significant. And one thing I would note is that like the best players tend to be, nobody's immune from them, but the best players and the best teams tend to be a little more immune. Like I don't like to say this right now,
like LeBron.
LeBron usually gets a game on the road. I don't want to think about that.
Yeah,
right
he had
now,
a, he had a great game in game two against the Celtics.
Right, he came out
even though they lost.
That's right, but it tends to be the Spurs. Those great teams always could win on the road in the playoffs. But it tends to be the more marginal players, the marginal teams, and maybe it's a question of a certain lack of mental toughness gets exposed.
Right.
When you go on the road.
Now we mentioned that crowds are very much into it, and they're like the. As the Seattle Seahawks say, the 12th man. They help psychologically a team get up. Now, I find that fascinating. That's on a few levels. Number one, sports seems to be an emotional experience rather than a rational one. I mean, if there's a questionable call, the entire 40,000 people at the stadium are going to hate the referee because they called it against the home team. Not one of those 40,000 are going to say, well, maybe he was right. It's not, I mean, real life is usually more rational, more reasonable than a sporting event, no?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, have you watched politics at all lately? I mean, the tribalism that John talked about, it kind of runs rampant everywhere.
That's very sad.
You
would hope that sports would be immune to that, because they're immune to a lot of other things, like a lot of other political correct things, and they're certainly immune to racism. You'd think they'd be immune to that, emotionalism.
I think the rational aspect happens only with a certain small amount. Generally, it's found more in those who actually pursue a certain virtue, to the point where they can, even if their vote, if their team is losing and the other team, you know, for example, like the, I remember the first time I started noticing this was the Yankees teams of the late 90s, early 2000s. And I'm a Red Sox fan, but I just remember being really, really impressed with, like, Joe Torre, their manager. I was actually wishing we had Joe Torre as our manager, that we'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And I wasn't saying hating Joe Torre because he was with the Yankees. I was thinking, he's such a good guy. I wish he was our coach. I wish he was our manager. You know, that the lineup that they had was super impressive. And the Red Sox had some really good teams that around that time, but the stumbling block was the Yankees. And even though I was rooting for the Red Sox, I was still impressed with the Yankees. Enough that I could I could say, you know what? The Red Sox are my team.
Yeah, but I tell you what.
Appreciate
if you were at Fenway Park and the umpire called somebody out on a steal that you thought was safe, or that it, no, that you thought it could have went either way, you'll probably stand up with the 40,000 and say the umpire has got to go and start screaming.
I don't know about that.
Bad call. Terrible call.
Yeah.
Terrible call.
Sitting here right now, I'd like to think I wouldn't, but there's too many memories flooding back right now that contradict that. So.
And gosh, before Instant Replay had its role in the past couple of years with baseball, do you remember those fights with the managers, between the managers and the umpires?
Weaver and Billy Martin back in the day.
Huge.
Speaking of which, I saw a clip of Lou Piniella having a little tizzy fit recently. Yeah, he was like...
He went crazy once or twice.
Like,
yeah.
Wow, is he like 5? No, he's like 75, but he's still acting that way.
978-454-4980. If you want to get in touch with us, we've got about 6 minutes or so left in our show tonight. Tonight we have been going beneath the surface on human nature and sports. Why we have them and why we care so much about them. Guests Dan Flaherty and John Tudoris. And did you guys think the Boston sports are special?
Yes.
Why is that? I mean, you've been from around the country, Daniel. John, you grew up in Rhode Island, so...
around New England. Connecticut.
Okay. All over New England.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why is it so special here?
I want to say, like, of all the cities that I've been around, like, I've been around Pittsburgh, been around Milwaukee, I also lived in the, you know, Baltimore, so you kind of throw the D.C. area in there.
Yeah.
The level of interest in all four major sports is as well-balanced as I've seen. Like, most cities seem to have to pick or choose. Like, in Wisconsin, everybody's crazy about the Packers.
Sure.
But, I mean, you know, the Bucks, you know, in spite of the good team they had this year, they could slide for 10 years and nobody would even
notice. Nobody would notice.
Yeah, I mean, they could lose, and people don't even care enough to get mad. I mean, you know, so it's, again, you go down to Indiana, like, you know, basketball is huge down there. But,
yes.
Like, but basketball at the pro level is not as popular because they expend that energy out of college.
That's right.
You know, with Boston, and again, maybe I'm partial just because I happen to like the team so much, it just seems you go from Red Sox to Bruins to Celtics, you know, to Patriots. And the Patriots are
the more modern
phenomena in that in the 21st
century.
That's
true, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, you don't miss a beat. And I know, like, a place like Philadelphia, you could probably say the same thing, too. And I have a lot of respect for them as a sports town.
I don't know. They don't really care about their Phillies that much, do they?
Actually, Philadelphia and Boston are very much similar as sports towns.
Yeah, I would agree.
Very, very similar.
All right.
I think those are the two most passionate sports towns in America.
Not New York?
With New York only because there's so many teams, there's multiple teams in each sport.
And there's a lot to do in New York, too. There's theater,
there's
everything else.
They don't like anything they're not
passionate
at the top.
They seem to be passionate about the Yankees, but I'm not sure about the other teams.
Well, they weren't passionate about the Yankees in the 1980s. You know, there was a Mets town in the 80s. You know, they kind of bandwagon hopper.
The Mets still have their diehard fans.
Yeah. Let's look at that word fan. It's short, isn't it? It's short for fanatic. Which goes to my earlier point that sports fandom is very emotionally based. It's not all that rational very often.
Using a broad brushstroke, I would agree with you.
Now, what's interesting is that the game itself has rules and it has a rationale to it. So it's no matter how much you want something to happen, if you don't play by the rules, you don't win, which is kind of refreshing in our world. There is an objective truth in sports, where many other phases of our modern life, we kind of reject that.
Perhaps maybe that's why cheating at the highest level is so vilified.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Right, because it strikes right at the core of what sports is supposed to be, that there's a clear ending. You know the winner, you know the loser, why, and that's it. Like, you know, we'll walk off the show today. We don't really know how we did. We don't get to look at a scoreboard and say
no scoreboard.
We won.
No.
But, you know, in Cleveland tonight, Boston and Cleveland get to walk off the court, and they know who won. So.
Speaking of, this is bad radio, but speaking of Boston and Cleveland, there's 8 minutes left. And the Celtics are down by 11.
Oh.
So, barring a miracle, it looks like that series is going to be 2-2.
I'm not surprised.
And again, just like the entire playoffs, the home team usually wins.
Yeah.
It's not that way in other sports as much.
Well, one thing I would throw out there, this is actually something I've thought about a lot, probably more than I should actually admit in public or anything like that. But,
now I'm looking forward to hearing it.
That's right. But, like, you know, baseball and hockey tend not to have as much of a home court or home ice advantage. You see the road teams win, certainly big game sevens on the road pretty frequently. And one thing I would say there, it's because those sports, the most important player is the pitcher and the goalie. And it's not raw emotion that drives success at that. It's precision in what you do. So as long as they're not rattled by the crowd, they're not going to be affected by by a hostile environment.
Or
they're not going to be able to be lifted up by a pro home environment.
Very good. Last thoughts? We have a few seconds left.
Like sports, they're good for you.
They're good for you.
But only in balance.
I would say, they're good for you, and not just because they make you a good citizen, that they're a way of glorifying God. They're a way you participate in a creative life.
Like you said, John, you don't want to idolize them in proper balance. It's the rest of life. Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Dan Flaherty of thesportsnotebook.com, as well as the author of Great 1980 Sports Moments. And Mr. John Tudoris, both of you, thank you for going beneath the surface on this topic of sports. Thank you all for listening. Paul Morano, Beneath the Surface.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.